This week we will be studying Ecclesiastes 3:16 through 4:16, which is the end of that chapter. Previously, Solomon pointed out the meaninglessness of life. Even the best life is just a brief repetition of pointless things, a continual striving, ending in death. But this week, Solomon points out that life is not just a futile endeavor, but also a painful one. Today's passage focuses less on the pains caused by nature and more on the pains caused by our fellow man. The emphasis today is on wrongdoing and injustice. Solomon saw injustice in the centers of power of his society, and he recognized that the weak were oppressed and miserable. The majority oppressed the minority, and a man with no one to help him, well, he has no one who will help. Such circumstances compel us to look at the nature of power and remind us that we need adequate rules and systems of governance to check the power of the powerful and to defend the rights of the weak. Your passage for consideration then is Ecclesiastes 3:16 through 4:16, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Today's passage is a passage about the corruption of the powerful and the misery of the weak whom they oppress. It begins in verses 16 through 18, in which Solomon describes the injustices he has seen. It is a remarkably frank discussion of the subject matter, seeing that it is given by a king. If anyone has an interest in portraying the powerful as all righteous, it is Solomon, and there is no one better suited to correct the injustices of the powerful than he was. And yet, we have the frank admission that even in the places of justice and righteousness, which I take are references to the courts, the government, the religious establishment, etc., there is wickedness. We must be careful not to excuse the failures of our leaders, and we should also maintain a healthy recognition that even the best leadership will at times be faulty. Solomon comforted himself in this a little by recognizing that ultimately God would have to judge and bring about justice. And he recognized that our human failures demonstrate us to be lesser than God is. We are, Solomon said, more like animals than we are like gods. Now we know that humans are different from animals. We've studied this before, as in Genesis chapter 2, when man was created. God made man mentally superior to the animals. We have a bit of the divine spark in that we are made in the image of God, and yet we have much in common with the animals. We're made of the same physical materials, not like the angels, and many animals have a very similar configuration to us. All mammals have four limbs and a head with ears and eyes and a mouth and so forth. But most relevant, we are all born and we all die. We may think that we are superior for our superior thinking, but in the end, there is no advantage to that, because our great minds have not significantly extended our lives. As we've noted in the past, the human lifespan has been unchanged for thousands of years. We have more people living closer to the maximum age these days, and thus a longer lifespan on average, but the maximum is still about the same. We die, and just like the animals, we rot to dirt. In this sense, Solomon declared that we all go to the same place. We're made of dust, and we return to dust. Let's be careful about parsing this. In saying that we all go to one place, Solomon is not making a claim that animals go to the same eternal reward or punishments that we do. He also isn't saying that animals have no life after death and that we don't either. In this verse, he's just making the point that we all die and turn to dust just the same. Solomon had no knowledge of whether or not there was any life after death, and so he made no claim that there was or wasn't. But in verse 21, he did ask the question, "Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth?" Well, in answer to that question, Solomon didn't know. This was a mystery to him. With that in mind, Solomon reckoned that mankind really isn't any better than the animals in the end. We die just like they do, and if that's the end, in a meaningless situation like that, he reiterates his conclusion from last week's passage, that we might as well just try to enjoy our work, because we have no way to know whether there is or isn't anything coming after this. And if this is all that there is with the injustices that Solomon had seen, it is a truly miserable lot. In chapter 4, verse 1, Solomon describes how the weak are oppressed and mistreated by the powerful, and there is no one to help them. Weep though they may, the oppressors have the power, and so the injustices are done. And of course, he's correct about that. That is the nature of the thing. The powerful have the power, and the weak don't. If the weak had power to defend themselves, then they wouldn't be oppressed. But they are oppressed, and there's nothing they can do about it. Unfortunately, whether or not the powerful abuse the weak is entirely the prerogative of the powerful. These circumstances demonstrate clearly the need for good laws, which can restrain the powerful, for systems that empower the weak, and for a distribution of the power and appropriate checks and balances to keep that power from centralizing. Without that, the weak will be overrun, and even those who can see the righteousness of their cause will do nothing to help them, lest they also be overrun. There is power in numbers, and there is always a real danger of the majority overrunning the rights of the minority. In such oppressive circumstances, Solomon reasoned that it is better to be dead than alive. He had supposed previously that having a little pleasure along the way was the best we can hope for in life, but if hopeless oppression takes away all our pleasure along the way, we're better off not to be alive at all. Solomon said in verses 2 and 3 that one would be better off to die or never to be born than to suffer that way. We note that, while death may be easier than life, Solomon's words here do not justify the taking of human life. Not an abortion of the young, nor euthanasia of the old, nor suicide, nor any other kind of murder. Human life is sacred, and while it is often a struggle, it is not for us to take it unjustly. Verses 4 through 6 are something of a non sequitur. Abruptly, Solomon went from talking about oppression to talking about work. The subject matter is relevant because often too much work is part of oppression. People are, for instance, worked to death to pay too much money in taxes. In this three-verse survey of toil, Solomon first noted that toil is often done out of envy. Really, we could all survive with very little. Simple shelter, enough food, clean water, and a fire to keep us warm. But of course, people want more than that, largely because they see their neighbors getting more. No one cared to have a cell phone 100 years ago because no one else had one. But now that virtually everyone has one, you've got to have one to keep up with the Joneses. People have to amass a certain amount of wealth to match the societal standard of living, and they often want more so that they can outcompete everyone else. Not that it does them much good in the end when they're all dead. It's just more vanity. Then again, in counterpoint to that, verse 5 gives us a new entry among Solomon's famous proverbs. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Laziness was a common theme in the book of Proverbs. So let's be clear, while Solomon speaks often about the vanity of work, work is also essential to life. However, the thing we should remember is that working and attaining wealth is not the sole purpose of life. It is essential to work so as to have enough, but verse 6 reminds us that it is better to have one hand full and a quiet life than two hands full and toil. So work, but don't make work your life's only purpose. For more Proverbs on the topic of work, you might listen to our message, The Wisdom of Work, published July 2, 2023. In verses 7 through 12 of chapter 4, we have Solomon's contemplation of a lonely man, which also relates somewhat to the topic of oppression. There is power in numbers. Many working together can oppress one who is alone, and a lone man suffers much. Solomon saw this miserable, meaningless thing, a man all alone with no son or brother. A man's sons and brothers help him in his work, and not only that, but they give him something to work for. A man with sons works to provide for them, and he works to leave them an inheritance. At least then there is something to outlive him. But a man with no son works only to purposelessly feed himself until he dies. Having no helpers, he works harder than anyone, and he does so with even less purpose. He works so hard that he doesn't even have time to ask himself why he works, and so he goes on toiling and depriving himself of pleasure, unhappy and accomplishing nothing. A lonely man has a sad life. It is much better for him to have others, his family, around him. Two people working together accomplish more than one alone. In the event of an emergency like a dangerous fall, the worker who has his brother working with him has someone to help him up. A man with a wife has someone to keep him warm at night. And when an opponent comes, a man with his sons around him wins in a fight. So keep your family close. A man with a family is much harder to oppress. And yet Solomon also observed that at times the tables do turn. Men with wealth and popularity are not invincible, and men of low rank are not completely without hope. In verses 13 through 16, Solomon described how a young man who has wisdom and not wealth might rise from the prison to be the king. Meanwhile, the old and foolish king might fall. Specifically, Solomon described this foolish king as one who would not take advice. We discussed that kind of hubris, pride that leads to the fall, in our messages on Solomon's Proverbs. See The Wisdom of Humility, published June 4th, 2023. Concerning the wise youth and the foolish king, Solomon had in fact seen this very circumstance. His father David had started out as a shepherd boy, had lived for many years as an outlaw, wrongly accused, and his accuser Saul was an old and foolish king who would not listen to the facts. Saul fell, and David took his place. So there is at least some hope for the oppressed. But then even in this, Solomon found the meaninglessness of it all. Even if the youth should rise up from his oppressions to be a wise king, what will it matter? A multitude will follow him, and then he will die, and the crowd will die, and the people will forget him. I am sure that neither I nor the overwhelming majority of my listeners can name many kings of antiquity apart from those mentioned in the Bible. So in the end, what does it matter? Perhaps it would have been just as well for that young man if he had never been born. In application today, we discuss oppression and the power imbalances that foster it. What gives a man power that he might use it to oppress others? In the first place, a man has the power of his own physical self. Some people by their nature are more powerful than others. One is born a little bit taller. He's got longer legs to run faster and a longer reach to get in an extra punch. Some, by nature, have stronger muscles. A man like that can force a weaker man into submission. Some have better minds. They can figure out how to get the upper hand. But those things are of limited value. Very rarely is any one man stronger than any two. Two men can almost always get the upper hand over one. There is strength in numbers. If you have more men, you have more power. Now, that isn't all that there is to power. Particularly as technology has increased, the ability of a few to rule over many has grown. With a nuclear weapon, one man can wield the godlike power to destroy an entire city, for example. But then even technology requires people. As Leonard Reed told us in his famous essay on production, no one man knows how to make a pencil. We need each other to do things. If no one man knows how to make a pencil, much less does any one man know how to build, maintain, and deploy an intercontinental ballistic missile carrying a nuclear warhead. Doing that requires a great many men, trained and learned in their fields. To get those men, you need centers of learning. You need funding to pay them for their work. And that funding will have to come from someone else's labors. You would need raw materials that they can work with. So when you start to count the cost, the key to power always involves having the support of a lot of people. In general, more people means more power. This, incidentally, is one of the reasons that democracy tends to be a good underpinning for running an organization. If the majority vote and their leader accepts their vote, then the majority get their way. But if a leader goes against the majority, he loses the support of his people, and then they go elsewhere to get their way without him. And so, this is a critical lesson for any leader to understand. Being a leader does not mean getting your own way. It doesn't mean having a bunch of people who do whatever you tell them to do. Being a leader means knowing what is best for your people and showing them the way to achieve their best. Good leaders support their people. And not just good leaders support their people, but members of any team need their teammates to accomplish their goals. It should be your goal not to selfishly seek after your own interests, but to seek to strengthen your teammates, and that will serve you well. How does a person win others to his side such that he can make use of his individual power? Sometimes it is done by coercion, as when a government takes taxes or slaves. Sometimes it is done by compensation, as when an employer pays his employees. And sometimes it is done by convincing, as when an orator summons volunteers to join his cause, for the value of his ideas. But there is an ugly side to teamwork and to majority rules. The fact is that while the majority often has the power to get away with whatever they want, that power does not always coincide with what is just. We recognize God as the ultimate source of both truth and power. He knows what is right, and in the end he will enforce what is right. It is best, then, to be on God's side. However, God's power is, from our perspective, somewhat slow to act. The final judgment will come, but it will come at the end, and until the end, men will often be left to our own devices. And so the majority of men, warped and sinful as they are, will often act in opposition to God's perfect justice. God has granted men certain rights. The Ten Commandments say you shall not kill. That means you have a duty not to take your neighbor's life, barring some extreme justification. And if you have a duty not to take your neighbor's life, that is because he has a right to live. And men have other individual rights as well. There is a right to liberty, that is, a freedom of movement, such that you have a duty not to kidnap. And there is a right to property, such that you shall not steal. A man has a right to his wife, such that you shall not commit adultery, and a right to his character, such that you shall not bear false witness. Every individual man has individual rights, but the majority might not respect those rights of the minority, and the strong in general might not respect the rights of the weak. They might ignore their duties and in doing so trample others down. When a weaker person or a weaker group of people are deprived of their rights as part of a pattern of behavior, we deem those so deprived to be oppressed, and the oppressed suffer. They are deprived of their rights, and there is nothing they can do about it. They don't have the people. They don't have the money. They don't have the weapons. If they had, then they would throw off their oppressors and demand their rights. But as it stands, their situation is bleak. That situation is all the more bleak when the corruptions of the crowd spread to the leadership. Unfortunately, when a democratic society becomes corrupt, their leaders also become corrupt. We can't expect bad people with wrong-headed ideas to select capable leaders for themselves. But even with the best crowds voting, or with the ideal leaders appointing other leaders from the top down, the fact is that power itself corrupts. If a man has the power to get what he wants without any check on that power, then he will get what he wants, and unfortunately, men being fallen beings, the things which we want are not perfectly good. Solomon, who was at least a relatively good king, saw it in his own day. Even in the places of righteousness and justice, there was wickedness. When the leaders become corrupt, society follows them. There is power in numbers. When a leader comes to power, he does so by the support of the majority, or at least something close to it. Even in autocratic societies, the leader only maintains his grip on power because other powerful people are willing to go along with him. And once he has power, even more will submit to him, even if they do so unwillingly. Revolt is costly. Most people will not push back against a powerful person, even if they know that person to be in the wrong. For that reason, wicked leaders will lead a society into more wickedness, and there must be restraints to hold wicked leaders to account. James Madison, framer of the U.S. Constitution and fourth president of the United States, put it this way. He said, "If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary." In framing a government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. As history has shown, that is easier said than done. All of these circumstances cry out to us the need for good laws. Laws exist to defend the weak against the strong. When we have no laws, we have the law of the jungle, that might makes right. The stronger can do what he wants, and the weaker is oppressed. But if a society is enforcing a good set of laws, then they restrain the strong and stop them from violating the rights of the weak. Of course, you have to have a good set of laws to do that, a set of laws which harmonize with the laws of God, and in so doing, you must comprehend what the rights of the weak are. And furthermore, there need to be checks and balances on those in power. Power should be decentralized so that no one person or group of people have too much of it. And the people to whom the power is spread must have some means of holding other powerful people accountable. I think it is evident that today Western society no longer has good laws and no longer has sufficient checks to rein in the abuse of government. For example, we've talked before about qualified and absolute immunity, legal pseudo-doctrines that protect certain government workers from personal liability for violating the law on the job. Well, if you've got a class of people who are immune from, and thus who are above, the law, then by the very nature of the thing, you've lost justice in society. And of course, it isn't just the system that is broken. It is the laws themselves which are enforced. We have government officials protecting sodomy, granting no-fault divorces, jailing people for trifling causes, etc., etc. We've been over this before. But the point to be made here is that there is hope for us. When the king, or by extension the statists, does evil, he shows that he is foolish. And when the king is foolish, he is ripe to fall. Solomon had seen that a wise youth, even one who was poor and imprisoned, was better off than a foolish old king, because by wisdom a man can rise above his station in life. So take heart, whatever your conditions, because there is hope for you. But then I know of another king who was born in lowly conditions, and who went to the prison, but who today reigns eternal. Solomon had no hope because he did not know about eternal life with King Jesus. We have a hope of eternal life and an eternal end to oppression under the reign of a perfect king. Let us look forward to that. To conclude then, today's passage, Ecclesiastes 3:16 through 4:16, describes more of the misery that Solomon saw under the sun, putting a particular emphasis on the injustice of oppression against the weak by the strong. By the nature of the thing, the strong rule over and can abuse the weak, and if they can abuse the weak, they will be prone to do so. In a state of nature, the weak have no way to defend themselves. Since there is strength in numbers, usually it is the majority oppressing the minority. Circumstances of oppression remind us of the critical importance of having a just set of laws and an effective legal system that is properly restrained. Solomon told of a man all alone who, because he was alone, suffered much. That man reminded us of the importance of having our family to stand up for us. Solomon also told of a man born weak and poor who rose above his station to become king. And of course, we recognize Jesus as our ultimate king. So take heart. Despite bad circumstances, we will overcome.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.